Thank you, Brian. Thank you very much. This is a wonderful pleasure to be here with you today to have some interaction and dialogue with two very, very important individuals. I'd like to thank OESA for planning and organizing and seeking out co-sponsors to help with this event. This is really an important time for Oklahoma. So I hope that when you leave today, not only will you know more about the candidates and their positions, but you would be sure to share that information with others around the state. Thank you all for coming. Thank you, candidates, for being here. Thank you, panelists, for being here. But most of all, thank you, voters, for being here. No one knows better, I expect, than the folk in this room about the importance of public education. Brian is right. I'm a product of Oklahoma City Public Schools. I started school during the time when schools were segregated. I can remember when there were no African Americans on Oklahoma City Public Schools Board of Education, and the Urban League at that point created something called the Black Board of Education. It was a shadow board that actually attended the meetings and gave voice to a community that was not represented. They also, on this Board of Education, allocated a couple of slots for youth members. So at 14 years old, I decided to run for office the very first time and ran for one of those youth slots and was elected. And I think it's really ironic that my very first and certainly my very last opportunity to serve in an elected office is related to education. But we understand the importance, and we understand how people in this country consistently and continually fought for public education, what we all consider the great equalizer. It was the one opportunity that individuals throughout this country would have to really grow and learn and prosper and share in the American dream. Public education must, it is an imperative that public education provide an experience for all, every single young person to succeed. And we have to make sure that systems and policies, programs and practices are in place, and the accountability is there to ensure that all of our children can be successful. So in my opinion, this really is the most important election on the ballot. So. So with that being said, these are the most important candidates on the ballot. So it's my pleasure now to introduce you first to our panelists, who you will hear from in just a bit, who will be posing questions. The first to my right is Rachel Dowdy. Rachel is a parent of a public school student. Next to Rachel is William, also known as Bill Frick. Bill is an associate professor in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Studies at the University of Oklahoma. And next to Bill is Mr. Seth Meyer. Seth is a public school teacher. He's a special education teacher, formerly in Norman, now teaching in Middale Public School District. And next to Seth is Dr. Dan Snail. Dan is a member of the Norman Public Schools Board of Education. He, too, must have had a moment of insanity when he chose to run for office, like I. No, I'm just teasing Dan. I've known Dan for a long time. He does great work. So thank you all for agreeing to participate this afternoon, this beautiful Sunday afternoon, and we really look forward to the questions that you pose. So we want to start by giving our candidates an opportunity for opening statements. They each will be given 3 minutes. We have a wonderful, lovely timekeeper sitting right in front of you. You will be given notice when you're halfway through your opening statement time and also halfway through the question and answer period. Once the candidates conclude their opening statements, we'll move right to our panel questions. Each of you can respond. We'll alternate who goes first, and you'll have 2 minutes each. So alphabetically, Mr. Cox, Dr. Cox, you go first.
I like to stand out here because I'm a teacher, so I like to be right here with you. But I just want to say thank you so much for you being here today, because this really shows that you care about public education and the needs that we have out here for our public schools. So thank you, Dan. So that's not part of my 3 minutes, right? All right, thank you. Thank you. Well, I'm Dr. John Cox, and I am just working extremely hard to be your next state superintendent. This is my 21st year of being an active school superintendent and my 29th year in public education. So I think this race actually is, it's not about Democrat, Republican. It's more about having someone in there that advocates for our public schools and children. That's what this race is about. So as I go across the state and I talk to Oklahomans, they are saying it is time for a school superintendent, an educator, to be your next state superintendent. So I'm just working hard to get the message out on what we need to do and what we're going to do when we get out into the office. And there are basically four things that I talk about. And the very first one is actually treating an individual, a student, as an individual instead of a test score. Because right now, we start in January at my school and we start test prepping all the way up until the test. And I just say that's so wrong, because what we're doing is taking the power away from the teacher to use their expertise in a classroom. And so I would love for the teacher to be able to have that classroom back and use their creativity to actually teach children again. And then again, you know, we test so much and we use assessments so much now that we don't even know if they're testing or measuring what they're supposed to measure. So I want to take a step back and look at these tests. For instance, third grade reading test, 49% language arts test, and we had about 8,000 children that failed. We don't really know the real purpose of why they failed. What was the reason? Was it because they didn't know a prefix or a suffix, or because they truly couldn't read? So, and then you take another step, and 4,000 about of those students are special needs children. Special needs children have an IEP that drives their curriculum, and really they should not be taking those tests. They should let the team take care of the IEP. So I've got to get out there and really advocate for that. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you look at the end of instruction test, and which is really another part of my platform, because business people out there are saying the end of instruction test for a high school diploma is actually getting in the way of workforce development, actually putting a skill in a high school student's hand when they walk across the stage at graduation. And I want to get back to doing that and making it real to our students, because that helps with dropout rates. If a student has an interest in being in high school, they will stay in high school, whether it's working in auto mechanics, working to be an electrician, any of the trades areas, because about 75% of our students do not go to college or do not graduate from college. So we need to put something in their hand instead of letting them walk across the stage right now and go, what do I do? What do I do now? Do I follow my friend to college? So we really need to get back, and that's one way we can improve school. Wow, that went really fast. Oh my goodness. Well, you'll learn more from me today. And I just want to thank you so much for being here. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It is really a pleasure to be here. I am a mother of four children, been married about 30 years. I raised all my kids in public school, K through 12. And was in business after a time of seeking, going back into the classroom after I taught. I'm a public school teacher, but then a business opportunity landed in my lap. It's called Kumon Math and Reading. I work with international curricular standards for hundreds and hundreds of students, actually 4,000 students I've personally instructed here in Oklahoma, and have an opportunity, I believe, to take a both business perspective as well as an international view of instruction and standards, and take that and work with the experience that I have as a State Board of Education member in order to lead. I was appointed to the State Board of Education, and it was there when I joined that board that I realized we had such a deep failure in leadership, and we needed to have a leader who had the ability to work with people and really bring a plan, because it's going to take an eight-year plan, I would suggest, in order to address immediate needs and lingering challenges in Oklahoma education. And the way we're going to get there is by working together with stakeholders, and that means our school leaders, our teachers, our parents, those in the business community, as well as community leaders all throughout our state. But we will never get there if we're not able to execute that plan, and that's going to require working with our lawmakers at the Capitol. And the particular composition of that legislature legislative body, third try, I'll get it right, is really, I think, composed in such a way that I have the very best hope of being able to negotiate that plan so that we can address three main areas. One, testing. We are over testing, and I hope we have a lot of time to talk about that in the future. Two, teachers. We have low compensation and low job satisfaction. And when both are low, we're in trouble, and we're already there. We're losing too many teachers to other industries and other states. And then the third thing is resources. Folks, we've got to get traction. We are underfunded. We are working with 40,000 more students on $2,008 dollars. That is growing class sizes, and it is causing us to not make the appropriate level of investment in education. I stand for a vibrant public education system. I believe we will get there if we work together, but it's got to be a priority. And I'm willing to fight and advocate for that at the state capitol so that we can get what our children need to have a first-class education with high standards that they deserve. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cox. Thank you, Ms. Hoffmeister. Did I say it right?
Yes.
Okay.
Perfect.
You're good. All righty. It's kind of like one of those kid movies. I have to tell you, it's your name. So now it's time for our panel questions. I'm going to ask that you refrain from applauding the answers. We'll make best use of our time, and we'll acknowledge our candidates and thank them again toward the end of the program. So to make this fair, we're going to go ahead and start with you, John, and then Joy, and then we'll alternate from
sure.
there. If you will ask your questions, we'll just go one at a time down the row, and each of you, to be reminded, have 2 minutes, and again, the timekeeper will give you notice after 1 minute is complete. Rachel.
Good afternoon. I have two children, or we, I guess I should say my husband is not here with us this afternoon. My daughter is 11 years old, and my son will be 13 in a couple of weeks. And my question is regarding Common Core. A lot of parents, including myself, and students are very confused and frustrated about their future regarding Common Core. How will we know if our schools are better as a result of Common Core? And if elected, do you plan on eliminating or reforming Common Core?
Yeah. Well, from the very beginning, I wasn't in support of Common Core. And the reason why is because it takes the creativity away from not only the teacher, but of the student. And I'm a really big learning styles person, so I believe that teachers really cater to the learning styles of their child. And Common Core kind of makes you put every child in a box where everybody has the same learning style, so it kind of takes away from that creativity. But when I go into office, I actually plan on bringing teachers in who I believe are the experts in every area and every grade level and discipline, bring them in and allow us to put it on paper so that teachers across the state can have something in hand, because right now they know from point A to B what to teach, but they want something solid in their hand that says this is what we're being consistent. And we can actually look at the national standards other states and be above what they have. So I was excited about this 10 years ago because I wanted at PEGS our children to be at a higher level than the other states, but more hands got involved and it became something that I didn't really think was vital for our kids. So, but I'm looking forward to the opportunity to be out there and be able to build our own standards with our own teachers. And I just think that we're smart enough in Oklahoma to do that. As I go across the state and talk to teachers, I say, aren't we intelligent enough to bring some standards so that we can have our hands on something that we can use for our children? And we spent millions of dollars already on Common Core and the implementation. So my plan actually comes in and we can use that training that we had to implement what we have. But bottom line, we need to get in there with our own teachers, our Oklahoma teachers who have expertise in these areas, build it, and then get it out across. And I don't see any problem with having high standards as a result of. Thank you.
All right. Well, this is certainly very dear to me because high curricular standards is what I've spent the last 15 years working with. The standards that I have been working with Oklahoma students on has been used and is currently used in 47 countries. We do need to recognize that our children are going to be competing for that job with members of the global community, and our children need to be prepared so that they have the skills in place that they can apply. But I do recognize that you can't apply what you don't know, and we need to have a focus on foundations. In 2013, the top 10 jobs didn't exist in 2004, and I have my priorities in such a way that I would like to see our students have the time for rich instruction, which when we spend so much time heavily focused on test prep and test questions, we end up pushing to the periphery those subjects that make for a well-rounded education. And I believe the next standards that are going to be written will be just, of course, math and English language arts. However, it's important that we are equipping our students with a set of standards that have already proven to have the evidence of great results, the kind of outcomes our children deserve. And so I would say, let's not start with a blank sheet of paper. Common Core through House Bill 3399 is not going to be a part of Oklahoma education. It's time to move on and write these in such a way that we have confidence they will produce what we're hoping to see for our students. And I would look at the NAEP test scores. Let's look at those states that have already produced the outcomes. Begin examining those, look at our past standards, find where we need to bridge, and do this in an effective way quickly, but not so fast that we are right back to where we started with inadequate standards.
Great. Thank you both. Bill?
There's an undeniable dominant discourse at the state and corresponding national and international levels of economic competitiveness and market progress. But children, youth, and adults have inherent worth that transcends simple monetary and economic valuation. What do you believe are the full social ends of schooling through the agency of the state?
Joy?
Well, that's a great question, kind of a great segue to what we just started to discuss in my previous answer. When we stop to think, what is the purpose of public education? My goal for my own children and for all of our students is that they are prepared to think critically, that they are, first of all, literate, able to be a part of a democracy where they are really synthesizing information and coming to conclusions through thoughtful deliberation. And this will, I believe, as we invest in this kind of time for rich development and growth, not simply preparing a student to regurgitate specific information, although I say that with great respect for, again, you can't apply what you don't know. So we do need to have a very strong base of knowledge, depth of knowledge. But it is paramount that our students are able to be engaged, that public education provides for them an equipping of the skills needed to be active, engaged citizens in the future, so that we continue to build on the rich heritage and freedoms that were fought by many, many before us and continue that legacy forward.
Thank you, John.
Okay. Well, I believe that public schools are out there for the purpose of having opportunity. And that's what teachers do, and that's why we've really got to get away from this test-happy society, because we can give opportunity for children to pass a test, but we can't force them to pass a test. And opportunity in high schools actually to give them a chance to be a successful citizen and also have a great life after high school. And so that's why I think workforce development is extremely important to what we have, because, as I said, three-quarters of our students, about 75%, do not go to college or don't finish college. So if we can really focus in on that population and give them a skill as they leave, then I think that's going to create a better economy, that's going to create more value in people, that's going to keep students in school, and really that's our purpose of public schools, is to give that opportunity to that individual child. And we've just gotten so far away from that in the last 4 years, so it's really going to be my focus to head that direction. And you know, on the flip side of that too, I love the concept of having the ACT Aspire family bring that into what we're doing in our testing, 3rd through 10th grade, so that we can raise every child up so that they can have a chance to do really well on the ACT as a junior and earn scholarship potential from there. So that will help the other 25%, maybe even increase more opportunities for our children. But if we can do that and align that for our students and get away from all this nonsense testing, then I think it's going to be more power to our children, and we're just going to give them a better opportunity to come out of our public schools.
Thank you, John. Seth.
Many teachers have described our current state superintendent as making very punitive and divisive decisions for our students and our teachers. If elected, how would educators describe you after your first term?
Okay.
Mr. Cox.
Well, I would have to say that I feel it every day. I feel the tension. I feel the pain in the gut that she gives our public schools every day because I live it. And you know, we're boots on the ground with this. So I would say that I'm a polar opposite person. My leadership style and how I've been able to stay at PEGS for 20 years is because I have an open door policy. And I actually listen to people. And if I have a concern or I need information, I'm not afraid to call other people. And that's how you survive in this business, is being able to call and get information. So I would just say that having that type of characteristic, after 4 years, people, well, I would say after the first 30 days, everybody's going to go, wow. Because they can get back to teaching again, they can have their jobs, they can love children, put their arm around the kid again, take care of the basic needs, and instruct. And so it's not going to take 4 years for that. It's going to take an immediate reaction when I walk in the door, because we've built up that network system across the state. People have confidence and faith and trust in me. And so I'm there to work for them. So as a servant, instead of somebody who's regulatory, which I'm telling you right now in our public schools, they're micromanaging everything. They're trying to make us look bad. They're coming after us. So that's why I'm in this. I'm in this to change the looks on our teachers' faces, where they have enjoyment in their classroom, and again, where administrators can love being part of public schools. That's why I'm in this. There is no way I'm in this for John Cox. That would just be absolutely crazy. I have to be in this for our public schools to change the entire environment. So after 4 years and after one day of being in there, people are going to know that they can trust, and it's going to be a different situation. Thank you.
Joy.
All right. I think folks would describe me after that first term as one that is marked by a leadership style of inclusive and collaborative leadership. But I think that the real thing that I would really hope people will say is that she didn't mistake motion for progress. Folks, we have to have traction. In public school, we've been working really, really hard. And we can't continue to do the same things that we've been doing for 20, 30, 40, 50 years. In Oklahoma education at this moment, we are sitting in a position where attention and focus is directed our way. Thank you to the last 4 years for that, because we have now, I believe, captured public opinion and interest in solving the problems, the immediate needs and lingering challenges. But it's going to require leadership from the State Department of Education, who is one that, and what I plan to do is have really groups that are like advisory groups that represent different stakeholders, from superintendents to retired superintendents, teachers, retired teachers, those specialty areas, special education, advisory group, librarians, the different services that are all part of a robust, vibrant public education system. And out of those groups, I want to see a process where recommendations come and they go to the state board, those that can be handled within the department. We take those recommendations and fix things that need to be solved, and then take recommendations to our legislators, and vice versa. Let's have an opportunity for legislators to come forward and meet with those specific groups before legislation is constructed, so that we are able to work in an efficient manner that is ongoing, with a framework designed to facilitate that inclusive and collaborative leadership. But we will be, I believe, noted as an administration with a four-year term that actually got something done.
Great, thanks. Dan.
I would like to ask about civic engagement. I think the data are very clear that our state does not vote as much as some other states. And I was thinking, actually, that perhaps voting is an inherited trait. You know, like my parents voted all the time, and I vote, and we'll see about my daughter. But how do you address that? How do you get people, especially young people, to vote and to be interested? Joy?
Yes, well, I think you've touched on that, perhaps. Modeling. You know, people see this in families, in the importance that a parent places on that civic responsibility. I think in education, we have that opportunity as well to model our responsibilities as informed members of a democracy so that we are able to help those who feel maybe apathy, that their vote doesn't matter, to recognize the collective voice of that one vote and how it can make a difference when we all take that responsibility. But it does, I believe it's an education issue as well as a family issue too. And we will certainly, I think, have to also address at the same time when we talk about voter apathy, that sometimes there's an overconfidence that others are going to represent us. And we are responsible to give our own vote and our voice, because perceptions are not where we should be setting policies. Anecdote, no, that's not, although it's important to hear, it's not how we should be making policies. I vow and promise and pledge today to act on evidence, not anecdote, not perception, and not make it so that we are listening in an imbalanced way to those who have the loudest voice or those who have the most savvy, slick presentation. It's very important that I believe as a leader, we are listening to all stakeholders, all groups, whether they agree or don't with one's own particular original position. It's very important to build that in as we make leadership decisions and then model that.
Thanks, Joy. John?
Well, I believe it was like 9% voted in the runoff this time. And so it's my job to get you out to vote. And so I am so excited that you're here today but I would love to see 200-300 people pack this room and see what's going on. So really it's a societal problem. But going across the state and seeing young Democrat clubs and young Republican clubs in these high schools, that's a great start to getting them active. And I actually had a 16-year-old boy at the Tulsa State Fair come up to me, and he knew everything about me. And when I walked away, I just thought, you know, that's just totally amazing, because he was in tune with what's going on. And so I'm thinking, why can't we get all our students to do that? Why can't we be out there? And so it's really my job going across the state to get people energized. And I just don't tell them to vote for me. I say, be active and go out and vote for our public schools. So that's my message to them. But I think it's so important that we really model our behavior and what we do with our own children. And then in our public schools, just model that that they get out and be engaged in what's going on and be active, read the papers and listen to the news and just really start forming opinions. So as I see that 9%, there's supposed to be low voter turnout for this election. And so I'm working extremely hard to get most of the state of Oklahoma to come out and vote, and I'm excited about that. But on the other end, we have a lot of work to do to change minds and get people engaged.
All right, thank you. Before we start our second round of panelist questions, I think there is someone with some cards that can be distributed to you who are in the audience. If you have questions that you'd like to pose to the candidates, raise your hand and someone will make sure you get a card, give our candidates a chance to take a sip of water and get ready for the next round. And if you don't get a card right now and then there's a question that you have later, just make sure you raise your hand and someone will see you. For the second round of questions, Rachel, we're going to start again with you. Joy, we're going to have you go first, and we'll just reverse the order so each of you will respond first to a different panelist. Ms. Rachel.
The current administration has created a huge trust deficit with our educational leadership. So many parents have felt left out of the process and believe that their children are victims of the system. In my opinion, we need to be transparent in our processes, inclusive in our deliberations, and accountable for improving education. If elected, what plans do you have to reconnect parents so that we can begin to feel good about our schools again? Why should we trust your leadership?
Well, that's an excellent question, and I believe it is really part of the overall solution to how we solve those immediate needs and lingering challenges in education. It is about parent engagement. We know that our best schools, regardless of where they're located, our best schools have engaged parents. And this is something that we need to actively foster. When we saw legislation this year that actually cut out the voice of a parent in terms of decisions that would involve their children with promotion to another grade level, I had a real problem with that. I'm always going to be one who does stand and have always stood with parents to engage them. This is, I think, key for any kind of legislation that moves forward. We want to provide also communities with information that is accurate, valid, and reliable. So one of the other pieces I think that must be addressed is our A through F grading accountability system. When I was a board member, I am one of two who voted no. Not because I'm against accountability, absolutely not. You know, schools are government. I believe in accountability. This is taxpayer dollars funding our school systems. We need to have transparency. We need to be open with those parts of our education and know what is working so that we can continue forward with those successes, but also shine a light, not a hammer, on those areas that need improvement. But I believe in local control too, and the need for an accountability system that is like a mirror that reflects back accurate information. Instead, what we have now is like a carnival funhouse mirror that's wavy, where you can look into it and you see reflecting back something that's distorted and not useful. So having the ability to work with OU and OSU will be for building that framework is going to be one of the first things I'll do. Start that conversation so we can get it right.
John?
Yes, trust is a key issue, and it's an issue across the board because as a school superintendent, I don't have trust in the State Department of Education. And across the state, that is the same message that's being put out there. But I built a trust across the state, and as I said earlier, we have over 400 superintendents out there and their communities fighting for this change, fighting for me and backing me into this position. Working with me. They know that I'm not going to be in front of them, but they're going to be right beside me walking in that door. So that has to change the environment of the communities and the trust within the parents. And so as we know, you know, the parents are the key. An engaged parent is the key to having successful students. We know that. So, and that's why we work hard in our communities to bring parents in and have them actively engaged. That's why rural communities, city communities, that is so important that you have these activities to bring parents into your school. But when you have a system like the A through F report card that is totally flawed, the statistics in it are inaccurate, it has no purpose except to incite our schools and finger point among us. And so if we are actually going to have something like a report card or an accountability transparent system, we need to have something that parents can understand and that superintendents can understand. 12% of my students actually represent the entire grade that my school has, 12%. So we have to look at that and actually have something that parents can look at. I tell parents and non-educators, I say, if you make an A in math and a C in reading, are you a B student? And I say, absolutely not. You're really good in math, but you need help in reading. And if we have to have a report card, that's exactly what it should say. It shouldn't label them and put a letter grade on it, but it should say what it is. Thank you.
Great. Bill.
I question the inevitability of accountability as the master rationale for contemporary education reform. How do you reimagine and ultimately remake the office of the superintendency?
Well, accountability itself lies in the community, lies within the public school itself. So what I see accountability as starts from the school board. And that school board members are elected by their community. If their school district isn't performing or doing what they're supposed to do, then that is where community gets out and elects new school board members. That's the true meaning of accountability. And then the administrators are accountable to the school board and the teachers thereon. But I think teachers are accountable to themselves. They get in the profession because they love children and want to make a difference in children's lives. So they have an intrinsic accountability. But if we're going to have something, we need to have tests that really measure what they're supposed to measure and have purpose. So I think when we talk about accountability, I don't think we should talk about testing and putting data on our schools and slapping us with a grade. I think we should look at, are we really performing how we're supposed to in the classroom? And that's really up to the local district. Local control is one of the other platforms that I didn't get to a while ago. And I just really believe that communities are the ones that are responsible for their school. As State Department of Education, as state superintendent, I'm supposed to be there to serve. Not come in and tell a community what to do, but come in and say, how can I help you? What services, what resources can we do to bring into your school? So I don't see this as a regulatory position. I don't see this as someone that keeps schools accountable. I see this as someone that serves schools and helps them with their accountability.
All right, now I'm going to ask you if you'll repeat the last part of the question, because I'm not sure if I have it correct in my mind.
The last part is actually the question. How do you reimagine or ultimately remake the Office of State Superintendent?
Okay, thank you. Well, I see this as a position of advocacy. It is an elected state office position that is definitely accountable, of course, to the entire state, but is one that has a built-in role of representing all parts of education, starting with Sooner Start, which begins at birth, which is part of this authority, the position overseas. Which is also combines an office out of our health department. It also has K through 12 sitting as the chairman of the State Board of Education. The position is also the chairman of the Career Technology Board, State Board of Education, and then also is a member of a regent on the regional university, what we call the RUSO board. For then you see you have birth all the way through into the higher education arena. So this position requires someone who can bring information to our legislators, who is going to work in partnership with our career tech, higher education, Common Ed, and our other services within the state to see a big picture and help then advocate for what is needed. Because again, this position doesn't pass laws. Is charged, though, with implementing with fidelity those reforms or initiatives that are produced through our legislators. But we must fill the vacuum right now that exists where we don't have an advocate for a strong, vibrant public education system. What I see instead is we are sitting right now at a point where many have an idea that public school is so broken that they want to replace it with a privatized system. And I would say we need to work a little harder to actually show what evidence there is, act on that evidence, not perception, not anecdote, and it takes an advocate to do it.
Very good. Seth.
To give some context about some of the schools that serve our students, my high school that I work at, we serve an 80% poverty rate. And our students on IEPs, there are 7 special ed teachers for 220 students on IEPs. I say that because recently there's been an elimination of modified state assessments for students receiving special services. Some of these assessments are required, a proficiency score is required to graduate, or in improvement from 1 year to the next. Do you agree with the elimination of the modified assessments, and what is one short-term and long-term measure that you can do to help this process?
Mm-hmm. John? Oh, I'm sorry, Joy.
Yes. Forgive me.
Okay, I think first of all, it comes back to respecting the IEP, the individual education plan, the notion of what makes our country great is an appreciation that we in public education seek to educate every child, regardless of their ability level, regardless of who their parents are, or the status they have in society. In public school, we open our arms wide and say, all who come, for as long as you're here, because we understand with mobility rates and that are less than desirable in many situations, we don't have children for very long. But as long as that child is within our classrooms, as a teacher, we roll up our sleeves and say, I want to serve you in the most individual way possible. But particularly, it is special education that is afforded that right. And what I am very concerned about is, and frankly, I would question if what we are doing is even legal, because it seems to disregard the individual education plan. You know, I believe it was Ronald Reagan who said, those closest to the problem have the best hope of solving it. And we can certainly see that applying in many situations, but particularly in education, those closest to the students know them best and have the best hope of serving them in the most effective manner. And I would work with our legislators, but I think we also have to work at a federal level with our federal delegation to provide opportunities to serve those students in a way that we don't shortchange them from seeing in them the potential, because I don't want to limit them by saying that they cannot accomplish something, because I believe every child has untapped potential. But at the same time, we must respect them and give them the dignity without asking them to jump through hoops because a lawmaker said it was important.
John.
Well, this is a passionate area of mine, because we're at my school, we're 78% poverty, and we're 26% special needs children. So I would have to say the testing that we're doing is absolutely wrong, and it violates IDEA and IDEA. And so, and I don't know, you may be aware, but the testing company that we just contracted with to do the portfolio assessments, their outcomes in it are totally separate from the outcomes that are in the C's that we use to build the IEP. So when they're trying to build the IEP, they can't even get the same objectives that are going to be tested on the test. So to me, we shouldn't even be testing special needs children, because we test them all the time. We give assessments like the Woodcock-Johnson all during the year, pre and post, and we're watching them, and it's really up to a team to say, is there growth? And if there's no growth, it's up to the team to go back and look at it and go, well, what can we do? What can we do to come back and make this a better IEP? So I really believe the assessments that we're using all during the year can be used for those students. I just think it's really degrading to a child. And I actually had a waiter in a restaurant here 2 weeks ago walk up to me and say, he saw my sticker on my, and he said, why did my school make my fourth grade child take a test they knew he was going to fail? Why? And I said, that's the greatest question, because we absolutely should not be doing that. We're degrading them, we're hurting their self-esteem, and when on portfolios itself, we could be working with life skills and other areas. So it is one of my missions to go in there and pull the testing away from special needs and allow the IEP to drive the growth and curriculum of that child.
Very good. Dan.
I think you're both aware of the For the People initiative, where board members, school board members, and administrators have for the past 2 years been looking at research about the development of teaching in making recommendations in Oklahoma. One of the key aspects of that is professional development for teachers. So I wonder what, as superintendents, you can do about that.
Well, I'm glad you brought that board up, because I've been actively involved in the COSA OSSBA vision for the last 2 years, and I've been on the governance part of that. But as far as professional development, I think that's a local control issue, and I believe that it really needs to be catered to the area that they're in, because as I travel the state, there are so many different needs in communities. Like up in Ponca City, they have their own need and their own industry that they need to cater their workforce development or their skill building towards. And so what we really need to do is look at it localized and see what we can do. But then across the state, though, the professional development that we have done on Common Core, that and we can actually use it to come and implement my plan on bringing the instruction. And I wasn't sure, Dan, if you were talking too about board member training along in there.
Well, it's certainly part of it, but it seems to me that the research does show that more professional development for teachers gives them job satisfaction and also better results with kids.
Right. Yes, it does. And we can see that, but we have to make sure that the professional development isn't focused and it's just not a gimmick that we're spending money to take them through. So as professional development for board members and teachers, I just see it as being extremely important to what we do. Professional development for a superintendent is extremely important. And so that's why with these National Board Certified Teachers, the process that they go through, we should honor and value what they've done and actually make sure that we take care of those teachers, continually take care of them, instead of reneging on our agreement that we made with them. That process they go through is extremely difficult and rigorous, and that has made them better teachers. So in my own system, I see that the more that we can provide those opportunities for exact professional development that they can use in their classroom, the more valuable our teachers are.
Joy. Right. Thank you. Well, recognizing the importance of a continuous improvement model, I think, is key. And this must be built into what I'm proposing in an 8-year plan. Right now in education, I believe we are trying to build, let's say, the highway 3 miles at a time. When we do this, we don't share really, I think, the vision with legislators in order to have a master plan that is going to deal both with teacher pipeline of our new talent, hopefully staying within our state, but also addressing the needs of our current professionals so that they continue to have professional development that is also competitive with other states around us. I know that there are other states in the surrounding area that have invested more funding for this kind of development that I know our current state seems to lack the appreciation for the need to invest in the continuous improvement of our teachers and also of our educators in leadership capacity as well. But building school capacity is something at the State Department level we can address, and this is one way to make certain that we have the proper funding allocated there. We can look at minimizing some of the overregulation that we have so that we are able to untie the hands of teachers. I recognize, and I hope I'll be able to effectively communicate this to those legislators and gain their trust, because this is key, that every mandate passed ultimately lands at the desk of a teacher. Until we realize that and then refocus limited resources in a way that can be more effective, we really are not going to solve this. And again, we will only be working very hard, but cannot mistake motion for progress. It's about traction, and this is a key piece.